Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Well, hey, TERFs and trannies. You're listening to Heterodorks.
Hey, TERFs and trannies. You're also listening to Heterodorks.
Oh, yeah. You were supposed to
do that. I was, but somebody's just a little too eager to do all sorts of things right now.
I know. I'm a little anxious about all of this electrolyte fluid stuff that I have to drink like a gallon of it.
It's not that it's electrolytes, Corinna. It's that don't get me started. Anyway, TERFs and trannies. This part isn't going to start until after we record. So you will be spared whatever Corinna's about to go through. And meanwhile, we have a special guest.
We do. She is Dr. Julia Mason. She is one of our longtime listeners and fans. She loves the color orange. I met her in Killarney earlier this year, and she is a pediatrician, and she is one of the people who is ringing the bell saying, what are we doing to these kids? And we are probably going to talk about that a little bit, and maybe talk about some other things, maybe including some permaculture. So welcome to Heterodorks, Julia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So how long, you live in Oregon also, right?
Although Julia is not actually literally in Oregon right now.
That's true. I'm in Montana. I'm in Montana at Wheaton Labs, which it's the domain of a giant doofus named Paul Wheaton. He's literally a giant. He's over 6.5 feet tall. And he's a permaculture dude and does a lot of stuff with alternative technology, I guess.
I see.
Like, I was just helping out. They've got a yurt that came from Mongolia. And you know how there's that lattice that makes the walls of the yurt? All of the pins where the pieces of wood cross are held by little strips of yak leather. And the ropes are all made of yak hair or maybe horse hair. And then it's got wool insulation and the whole thing. And then it's going to be, I am told it's going to be a yoga yurt to try to get some more female energy on this property. Because right now it's a bunch of, as I mentioned before we started recording, it's a bunch of mountain men here cutting down trees and building things and burning stuff.
I don't know if that'll get female energy, but that could very easily get some Corinna and Nina energy.
Oh, yes. It's the yak leather.
Burly men, Corinna. Burly men doing hard work.
Yeah, wearing yak leather. Wearing yak caps.
Haven't seen anybody wearing a leather other than boots. But it's cool. It's cool to be here. I'm glad to be. Actually, it's nice to have a break from all the gender stuff, because gender has been sort of an unofficial second unpaid job for me for about 5 years now. Because I'm still working full time as a pediatrician.
You must get some burnout though, right?
Yeah, so I go to the mountains to recharge.
Okay, so here's where differences between Corinna and I make for better podcasting. Corinna knows you better because you got to meet and hang out in Killarney, but I didn't get to meet you because I had COVID. So
I was very sad about that.
It was sad, but now I get to sort of meet you while other people can listen. So how did you get to the point where you were speaking out about gender stuff as a pediatrician? You said 5 years you've been in this?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
pretty sort
much
of
5 years. It was the end of 2018.
How did you peak and what did it and how long before you said anything and what inspired you to be public when so many others are silent?
Yeah. I can remember hearing about like the idea of a transgender child after I moved from Wisconsin to Portland. So sometime, say, 8 years ago, it was one of those NPR driveway moments where there was an article, you know, they were doing a story and I got home from work and I sat in the car to hear the end of the story because I was just like, wow, this is a thing. And then it was, I think, 7 years ago that I had my first patient who came in and said, I was born a girl, but ever since I was two or three, I've been insisting to everybody that it was a terrible mistake and I'm actually a boy. And she had this cute story about how if people said to her when she was little, well, if you're a boy, then where's your penis? And she happened to be one of those kids where her belly button stuck out. So she'd point to the little outy belly button. She's like, there, that's it. That's my penis. And everybody laughs. It's a very cute story. She was one of twins, girl twins. And when she'd been a patient in the office, but I hadn't seen her. But when she came into, you know, my exam room, she was presenting very male and, you know, sort of already passed as a boy. And I was like, oh, you're transgender. I've heard of that. That's like a thing. The Children's Hospital, they've got a clinic. I can give you a referral. And I gave the referral. And then she came back to us and was like, oh my God, testosterone, it's a shot. And I hate needles. And I'm supposed to do this to myself. I can't. And we said, it's fine. It's fine. Just come here with the medicine and we'll give you the injection. We can't charge for it, but you know, it's fine. We know you. Just call us before you show up. And so we did the first few injections and then we taught her grandmother to give the injections and, you know, and then she wasn't coming in, but I was still seeing her like every 3 months or so because I was treating her for ADHD. And so I got to see the transition happen. And initially it was all very exciting and she's getting a beard and voice is changing. But what I saw was that it's like all of her energy was going into being trans. She did graduate high school, but she didn't go to college. She didn't learn a trade. She didn't do anything like, I don't know what, you know, the task of adolescence is to do hard things to set yourself up for an easy life later. At least that's the way I look at it, you know, either learning a trade or going to college, getting a degree, doing something, you know, doing something hard now so that later on you're set up. And that wasn't happening. And then another patient came in with her mom and they're both smiling. And she's like, I'm trans and I need a referral to the trans clinic. And I'm like, huh, you don't really look trans to me. I mean, I don't know. I'm just, you know, I'm like, okay, I gave the referral. And I was kind of thinking that she would be sort of differentially diagnosed out of it. Cause this is back when I thought that people did some sort of evaluation to decide who was truly trans and who should transition and who was just a little confused and needed some counseling but would be sent on their way. But she was transitioned and then another. And then I just realized that every single kid that went to the gender clinic got one diagnosis. There was no differential diagnosis. There was no evaluation happening. And when I had a 12-year-old be offered puberty blockers, I was like, wait, what is that? This person has already been having their periods for a year. So what are we doing with these puberty blockers? Like, what is the point? You know, like the puberty has already pretty much 3/4 of the way done for this person. So what is the point? You know, so I just started getting confused and then I started doing some reading and I think I found James Cantor's takedown of the 2018 AAP statement before I read the whole 2018 AAP statement. Cause you know, and you know how it goes. And a lot of the listeners know how it goes. You start looking and then you rabbit hole and then suddenly you're just reading all these things and your mind is blown. So
and the AAP,
at that time in 2018, yeah.
American Academy of Pediatrics.
Yes, American Academy of Pediatrics. I am a fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I think you need to be board certified to be a fellow. But other than that, you know, there's no other criteria. Just giving them hundreds of dollars yearly seems to be what it takes. And definitely not all pediatricians are fellows of the American Academy of Pediatrics, but the AAP claims to have around 60,000 pediatricians as members. And in 2018, while I was beginning to get confused, they were writing up not guidelines, but a statement. And the statement is unusual because it's got this little paragraph that says, This AAP statement was written by Dr. Jason Rafferty, and he is solely responsible for its content. And I've never seen that in any other AAP similar, you know, document that goes out. Yeah. So it tells me that somebody was a little uncertain about the content of the statement. But
that's for the plaintiff's lawyers to follow up.
No, I guess no so. Yeah, the, maybe in discovery.
Discovery materials.
We'll figure it out. But this statement is amazing because it basically says that if you are presented with a child and they don't make any age distinctions here, could be a 5-year-old. If you're presented with a child who attests to a cross-gender identity, then there are 3 things you could do. One is you could try to convert them back to being cis, and that's evil and wrong, and you shouldn't do it. And the other one is you could do watchful waiting, which is what was commonly done through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and early 2000s, which is you just kind of hang there and see what happens when they hit puberty. But this is also evil and wrong, and you shouldn't do it. Or you could do the right thing, which is to affirm the child in their chosen identity. And then it just sort of spells out the steps, which is social transition, puberty blockade, cross-sex hormones. Yes. But it basically, they offer no particular criteria for how to identify which kids other than just to ask them. And the Endocrine Society has guidelines that predate this. And they talk about using puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones, but they very carefully state, we have no idea how to identify which children to put on this path. And so, you know, you were mentioning lawsuits, Corinna. This is sort of a light shield against that. But the AAP just leapt into that breach. They're like, oh, we know how you decide. You just ask them.
Yeah, what could go wrong?
Yeah, what could possibly go wrong?
Now, that was a few years back that they did that, right?
Yeah, it's been 5 years since the AAP put out that statement. And traditionally, documents like that are renewed every 5 years. Mm-hmm. So I have to assume that they're working on an update right now. But of course, everything is cloaked in secrecy. And other than knowing which committees are working on it, I don't know anything about how that process is going. I'm learning a lot about how the AAP functions over the past few years.
It's been a few years. This is becoming a very highly visible topic in the media. The AAP is depended on by physicians inside the practice and outside of the practice. I'm sure that given the importance of the issue and the tremendous impact that transitioning a child would have on their future development, that the AAP has started a systematic review of the evidence. Is that right?
Funny you should say that. Something I'm known for is submitting resolutions to the AAP's annual leadership conference. Asking them to conduct a systematic review of the evidence. Because if you're trying to do evidence-based medicine, there are various levels of strength where the weakest thing is the opinions of the great men, You know, like, what do we do? Let's ask the smart old guy. He'll tell us what to do. That's the least reliable. And then you get into observational studies, and then you get into things like random controlled trials. But the pinnacle of deciding what to do is a thing called a systematic review of the evidence. And it's a particular thing where you actually publish your search criteria ahead of time. There are places where you publish this and you're like, we're going to look at all da 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 for papers on X, Y, and Z. And you know, you say what your criteria, basically what your search criteria are. And that way you can be held to account. Someone will be like, well, I ran that search you said, and, you know, Hobbs et al. 2022 should be in your review and I don't see it there. And, you know, like that. So you can't cherry pick which studies you want. You need to take them all if they meet your criteria. And then there's a whole nother set of things you do to try to determine bias in the studies that you look at and try to adjust for the bias of the various studies. So no one really has done that. Definitely no one in the AAP has done that. Finland did this and decided that they needed to change their practice in with regards to pediatric medical transition. Sweden has done a systematic review of the evidence. England or the UK have also. And all of the countries who have done a systematic review of the evidence have subsequently kind of said, oh, let's slow down here. You know, the evidence is not strong that doing these things to children necessarily improves their lives. But I started because in the fall of 2019, so prior to the pandemic, I went to the AAP national meeting. It was in New Orleans. And I went there trying to like talk to other pediatricians, ask questions, figure out what's going on with all this. And I went to my regional breakfast meeting where people were reporting on the various projects they were doing. And my region is, you know, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Hawaii, Alaska. And people made their various presentations, and then there was an opportunity to ask questions. And I stood up and I said, I'm concerned about what's going on with pediatric transition. I don't think that we're looking at the evidence, et cetera. And the guy that's like the leader of the region told me, oh, you know what you need to do is you need to submit a resolution to the annual leadership forum. And that's how rank and file pediatricians try to influence what the greater academy does. And I was like, oh, okay. And I sat down. And then when the meeting was over, I went to him and started asking like more particular questions. Like, okay, so where do I send this? What's the deadline? Who do I talk to? And I could tell from his reaction that this was just sort of his go-to for annoying people, just to tell them they need to submit a resolution. And usually they just bugger off and don't bother him anymore. But I really did want to. And at that point, SEGM was already in existence, the Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine. And so I knew that I would have help in getting something together, which was great because the deadline was in like a week. But we put together two resolutions and they went to the annual leader. It was called the Annual Leadership Forum at that time. And they did not have sponsors because I had a week. And so they sort of died a quiet death. I attended, you know, a meeting like via Zoom because by the time they were doing it, we were in lockdown. And they sort of called it and they're like, any seconds? And it was silent on the Zoom meeting and then moving on. So that was the first year. The next year, a different pediatrician who I didn't meet until after she wrote the resolution submitted one. And she did get a second at the meeting. And then, yeah, it's weird. We lost a year because of the pandemic and I feel like I'm losing a resolution. But yeah, then we did one with five co-authors. That was last year. Sarah Palmer was the Indiana pediatrician that submitted after me. So Sarah Palmer and me and three other pediatricians. And then this year, I submitted a resolution with 23 and me submitting a resolution. And basically last year and this year, it was the same, just asking the AAP to do a systematic review of the evidence.
And This is not an ideological organization, right?
Well, the AAP has always been political. The funny thing for me is, as a bleeding heart liberal, I was always cool with that. You know, like the American College of Pediatricians, the ACP, was founded, I'm not sure how many years ago, 10, 15 years ago, after the AAP came out in favor of allowing gay couples to adopt children. There were pediatricians who were conservative, and that's it. That's a bridge too far, and they formed their own organization. So generally, the AAP has always leaned very, very much to the left. They're in favor of gay rights. They're in favor of gay couples adopting. They're in favor of gun control, Medicaid expansion, you know, insurance for kids. We like that. In favor of vaccinations. All these things that are now becoming definitely tribal indicators. Yeah. But that was all fine with me until this one topic. And then this one topic, I was like, wait a second, this doesn't make sense. And I found these other people who seem to make more sense than you guys. But I'm not getting anywhere.
Did you, when you started saying something, did you start getting pushback? Did you have any pushback in your own community where you practice? Did you get pushback in the profession?
Right. One of the first, other than talking to people who were sympathetic to my views, sort of online and in meetings, I stood up and asked a question at a presentation at that 2019 AAP meeting. They had three different gender doctors presenting on pediatric medical transition, and they put it in a double-sized room, but it was still packed. And the doctors were so happy because they assumed that the reason the room was packed with pediatricians is because we all wanted to learn how to be life-saving heroes like them. And they were basically like, you know, there's no particular plan for this. We're all kind of making it up as we go along. If I can do it, you can do it. That was the attitude. And one woman was actually doing sort of an informal fellowship. She had young pediatricians right after their residency going to work with her to learn how to become gender doctors and be life-saving heroes. And I stood up and I asked a question. I don't remember what it was, but my skepticism was apparent. And then the whole thing ended and I got swamped with other pediatricians who were like, oh, I'm so glad you asked that question. I am really concerned about this. This doesn't make any sense to me. I don't know what's going on. And so I really feel like most of the pediatricians in that room were like me, just like trying to figure out what's going on. Sadly, you know, that was 2019. In 2020, 2021, we didn't have in-person meetings because of the pandemic. And then in October of 2022, we finally had another in-person AAP meeting. And I kind of wondered, like, I'm going to go to this. And I've been out for years now as somebody who's, you know, skeptical of this. I wonder what's going to happen. Am I going to be, you know, mobbed by thankful pediatricians? Am I going to be chased down the hallway by angry young doctors? But actually what happened was a whole lot of nothing. I think all of the pediatricians who didn't like what was going on just didn't go. They looked at the program, they looked at what was going to happen, and they just decided not to spend their money to fly to Anaheim, California and have that be their, you know, CME project for the year. So I didn't encounter a lot of sympathetic pediatricians. I didn't encounter, you know, I didn't get that many conversations with people in opposition. And then as far as at work, I am very lucky in that I work in this vanishing species, the small, independently, privately owned pediatric office. So I don't work for Kaiser. When I moved out to Portland, I interviewed with Kaiser and I kind of wanted to work for Kaiser because they have a pension. When you retire, they pay you a pension. And that's definitely profit sharing. That is the surgeons sharing profits with the pediatricians because pediatricians do not bring in that much money. But I did not get the job with Kaiser and I was sad, but now I'm very happy because I'm working at this small, independent, private office, and my boss is sort of a classic Western libertarian, and he knows what I'm doing and he's totally fine with it. And they, you know, and they've been really helpful in terms of clearing out my schedule when I need to go to a meeting or something like that. So I'm not in danger of losing my job, and I work not in Portland, but in Gresham, which is sort of the grotty working class suburb of Portland to the east. And so my patients are probably 80%+ using Medicaid. And the parents are working class and they're busy, and they're too busy to worry about culture war topics like this. They're just worried about, you know, getting groceries and paying the rent and getting their kids to school and all that kind of stuff. If I was practicing in Portland proper, I'd probably have more problems. But I did get posters with my photo put up in my neighborhood saying that I was a horrible transphobe. Watch out. And it said I was it said I was an ally of Ron DeSantis, who I've never met, and I'm definitely not an ally, but yeah. Luckily some people saw them and tore them down.
Where were they posted?
I didn't get my car keyed. They were sort of posted on light poles in my neighborhood. Just in the neighborhood where I live. They took a picture of me off the internet and printed it up. And, you know, I think it was like a handwritten, you know, it's very high tech. But yeah, it was just 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper stapled to light poles all over my neighborhood.
It said, Julia Mason has a posse.
That would have been better. No, Obey. It just said, watch out for this transphobe. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that's really actually terrifying, isn't it? Having that there be somebody near you, close to you, that's trying to stir up this sort of resentment and anger towards you?
I guess by the time it happened, I had learned that people... It's hard to get people to do anything, including violence against people that they hate, thank goodness. But like when I first got onto Twitter, which was, I don't know, I think 2018, either late 2018 or early 2019, I got swarmed. You know, I said a few things and I got swarmed, and they're like, we're gonna make you lose your license. You know, we're gonna report you to the medical board. And I'm like, all right, good luck with that. You know, I await what happens. And nobody even filed a complaint because it's nonsense. And actually, somebody I know was doing some, sketchy is too strong of a word, but was sort of operating outside of their field of expertise. And they did get reported to the medical board. And so I got to see how that whole thing goes. And generally, they look at what you're doing and they're like, yeah, we think what you're doing is inappropriate. And this is what you need to do to make it right, you know, so that you can continue to operate as a doctor. And so for this person, it was like, you need to stop writing for those strong psychiatric meds because you're not a psychiatrist. And if you want to continue to write for those, you need to have a psychiatric practitioner, you know, like look over your charts and make sure that you're doing it right. So, which I thought was totally reasonable. But anyway, because I'd seen somebody go through that process, I was like, yeah, go for it, guys. Report me to the medical board. I'm waiting, but maybe one of your listeners will report me to the Oregon Medical Board, and then I can see how that process goes.
What I would say is, if you're thinking about reporting Dr. Mason, please make sure that you're a resident of Oregon. Otherwise, that's perjury.
Oh yeah, we do have quite a few good hate point. Listeners. So, do your thing, hate listeners. Yeah.
I think maybe you need to have been one of my patients, or I'm a pediatrician, so you could be the parent of a patient.
Well, one thing I'd like to know is what sort of things are you working on now? So you've been outspoken for 5 years and you did mention Segem.
Yes. Okay. So I'm a founding member of the Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine. And we are we're not a membership organization, but so we're a loose conglomeration of doctors, psychologists, researchers, statisticians who kind of get together. Sometimes it feels like we get together and complain about how terrible the research is. But we've been writing rebuttal papers. We've been writing letters to the editor and sometimes getting them published. We've been writing original sort of review papers. And we're going to have conferences in the future. We've been working with universities to produce some systematic reviews of the evidence, since I can't get the AAP to do it.
So SAGM's a pretty small group. If you're working on even with the university to produce a systematic review of the evidence, that must be pretty tough, right? Because that's something that's usually a larger scale type of research.
It is. We are definitely punching above our weight in terms of being an organization. A lot of that, I think I'm going to give credit to Evgenia Abruzzese, Zhenya, who was the founder, and she's out now. She was on Gender: A Wider Lens, so I think I can say her name. And she is a force of nature. A lot is happening because of her. Like when I went to the AAP meeting and I stood up and said my piece, and then I was told that I needed to submit a resolution. And by the way, the deadline's in a week. I called Zhenya and I'm like, Zhenya, I've got to write this thing and it needs references. It needs to have all the data. And with her help, I was able to put something good together in a week. And the papers with Stephen Levine and Zhenya, I think, are very good. And so if people are looking for more information, the first one was called Reconsidering Informed Consent. And that's a good summary of some of the issues with pediatric medicalization. And then The Myth of Reliable Research is specifically a takedown of the original Dutch studies. So that's some good output that people can check out. We can have a link.
Those are the gold standard studies.
the Dutch studies?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a rather cheap, tarnished brash gold standard. They started with little over 100. They ended up with 55, one of whom died from a transition-related infection. And it was directly related to the fact that this male had been given puberty blockers. And so when they were doing the vaginoplasty, they had to use gut material, and your gut is full of germs, and he ended up septic. And that's a pretty high casualty rate, you know, for an innovative new medical practice to then be pointed to as the gold standard and what everybody should be doing. You lost one out of 55.
There's something I think I understand about the Dutch studies, but I feel like you could explain it better since you've been pretty critical. Mm-hmm. What I understand is that they have this cohort that they started with. They have done some long-term follow-ups, and this might be the only group so far of adolescent transitioners for whom we have a long-term follow-up. My understanding is that in the long-term follow-up, the results are fairly neutral. It's not that anybody had a particularly bad outcome, but there's not really any indication that this cohort has really thrived as compared to other age matched individuals in that area.
I think that's reasonable to say, and it's also important to note that they were very carefully selected from the pediatric, you know, population of kids presenting to the gender clinics. They ruled out anybody with an unsupportive family. They ruled out anybody with a significant mental illness. They didn't, you know, they didn't want to mess with anybody who was less than stable. They were giving these kids therapy all the way through. And the results that they have could be attributable to the therapy that the kids were getting. You know, they don't have a control group. We don't really know why they're doing okay, but they basically selected really stable kids and then put them through this whole process. And they haven't published long-term, like they haven't published long-term data.
Isn't stable kids an oxymoron? Like, especially with teen, I mean, kids aren't stable. That's the whole point. They can't be stable.
Right. I think one way to put it is sort of personality type. They really selected for the solid, stable kids. You know, there are kids who are very dramatic. You know, talk about orchids versus dandelions. They selected for the dandelions or the daisies, you know, the kids that are more phlegmatic. And they also did this fascinating thing where they used the Utrecht Gender Dysphoria Scale, which has questions like for the boys to fill out, I hate having erections. And it's got questions for the girls to fill out, like I hate having periods. And then they administered this questionnaire to them at intervals. And then after they had done the surgeries, they switched the scales. So they're asking females if they hate their erections, and they're asking males if they hate their periods. And even after surgical sex change, you're not having periods and you're not having erections. So, or at least no erections that you haven't made happen with a little pump. So the score's improved, but I think I could have taken a gender dysphoric child and then given him a fetching hat and told him that that totally made him look like a girl, and then given him the girl scale, and his score would have improved maybe just as much. Just flipping the scales was a weird thing to do. Having gender-specific scales was a weakness of the research.
Well, even if the research is weak, is it possible that if these kids are thriving as adults, that this type of treatment actually maybe has some value?
Well, I hear people talk about the thriving gender patients. I know they must exist. I've had one who did go on to college. I can't tell you. The one I mentioned who didn't really strike me as a convincing male, but did, you know, but did get affirmed and started on testosterone, had top surgery in the summer between high school graduation and going to college. And I saw her one more time for a physical after they were going to college. And she was talking about how all the trans men had the same voice. And that was funny. But I think she was transitioning to be trans. She wasn't transitioning to be stealth. And she seemed to be doing okay. But there were more who sort of stalled out, like the first patient I mentioned. And, you know, they're 19 years old. They've graduated from high school. They're working for minimum wage at a grocery store. And just not really, yeah. That first patient I saw on a down day, and he said, every time I have a girlfriend, they leave me for a real boy, which is sad. But yeah, I'm sure there's a variety of outcomes. Rita Kerta Caltiallo said and published that if they came into the gender clinic pretty solid psychologically speaking, they're doing okay, and really their only complaint was the gender complaint, then you could transition them and they would continue to do okay. But if they came into the gender clinic and they had other issues, the transition did not fix the other issues. So I guess I can say that. I agree with her on that.
Seems like most kids that go to a gender clinic have other issues.
These days, yes, the overwhelming majority. Something I hadn't mentioned about my peaking when I turned on this whole idea. The first red flag was when everybody from a pediatric endocrinologist to a trans woman that ran a youth group for kids told me that 99.9% of kids put on puberty blockers would go on to the rest of the process, the cross-sex hormones and the surgeries and all that. And then they'd look at me like, see? See? So 99% of them go on. So obviously the kids just know. They know who they are and they continue. And I'm like, 99% of 12-year-olds can't hold on to what they're going to be for Halloween in 3 months. That no, 99% 99% of 12-year-olds are continuing on, that means that these puberty blockers are not a harmless pause, a harmless, totally reversible pause. They are an active intervention that is concretizing what could have been a temporary cross-sex identity. And I still believe that.
Suppose it is concretized. Suppose that these a girl who gets it into her head that she wants to be a boy or a man. A lot of these girls, they want to be gay men. Let's suppose they do have puberty blockers. And let's say they do take testosterone and grow facial hair and start sounding like frogs. Then let's say they like living like that. Let's say they're happy that way. Maybe they like working at the dollar store and having a little he, they pronoun badge. And what if that's working for them? Isn't that okay?
Well, I think someone I know says we need to do some calculations on the NNT, which is a medical decision-making statistic called the number needed to treat. So for example, with C-sections, you have to do 60 or was it 600? You have to do a large number of C-sections to save one child from a brachial plexus injury that, like, you know, difficult birth and then their right arm doesn't work well because the nerves got stretched. So once they ran those numbers, they're like, okay, we need to slow down on the C-sections. You know, we're doing too many. There's often number needed to treat calculations for things like statins. How many patients should we treat for statins? How many to save one heart, you know, to keep one heart attack from happening at various cholesterol levels. I think we need better data because an interesting thing is there were kids who didn't make it into the Dutch protocol and somebody followed up with them. And the vast majority of them were like, yeah, I wanted to transition, but I'm all right now. You know? So I do think that the urge to transition in a child or an adolescent is a thing that should be paused.
The urge should be paused.
I don't want to pause their puberty. Yeah. I don't want to pause their puberty. I want to pause their urge to change sex. I think that that's an adult decision. And I think that you need to be in a really good and stable place before you make a decision like that. There are so many paths in to gender dysphoria. And there are also many paths out.
It turns out that urges, that sense of urgency, no matter what it's about, tends to, when you get older, you realize it's a sign that you're actually not thinking right. Like for me, urgency, if the house is actually not on fire and there is no immediate danger, it's a sign that something's not right, that I'm not.
It's like a clue. You're like, oh, I need to think about this.
Yeah, I need to pause.
Yeah. Adolescents in particular tend to make decisions with the emotional part of their brain. The emotional part of their brain is much stronger than sort of the front of the brain, the executive function, the weighing the pluses and minuses, all that kind of stuff. They're not so good with the weighing of pluses and minuses. They want what they want, and they want it now, and that's normal. And then the other thing I want to emphasize is that just developmentally, I think it's a huge mistake to do a social transition on a small child. Because small children go through identities on the regular. Like, that is not a weird thing. I had a patient who insisted he was a cat, and he was way ahead of the fad. You know, he did this years ago. But he was a gifted child, brilliant child on the autistic spectrum. And for a solid 2 years, I think from age either 6 to 8 or 5 to 7, it took a while before he would speak. I had to like stroke his head and, you know, pretend he was a cat for a while. I had to like accept him as a cat, and then maybe I could get him to talk to me about what was going on. But not forever.
So you are feline affirming then?
I am definitely feline affirming, as long as nobody gets out their surgical implements or hormonal treatments. Something that I want to get out to your listeners is that if you have a child who is less than 8, or definitely less than 7, a child young enough to believe in Santa Claus, they are going to believe you if you tell them that the fact that they're a boy who likes girl things and wants to have sparkly fingernail polish and would rather dance than throw a ball means that there's something wrong with them. They have a girl's brain in a boy's body, but no problem. It's cool. We're gonna pick out a name for you. We can pick out a girl's name, and we'll send you to kindergarten saying this is Jocelyn, and we're gonna use she/her pronouns, and you'll use the girl's bathroom, and it'll all be fine. And then when you're older, the doctors will change your sex. If you say that to a small child, they are gonna believe you. They're gonna believe that when they're older, the doctors will change their sex. And we really, really can't. We cannot do that. And to say that to a child, I think, is cruel. I think it's the wrong thing to do. And I put that in an article that I submitted to the journal Pediatrics. So the American Academy of Pediatrics has a journal. It's called Pediatrics. And I wrote some emails to Lewis First, who's the editor-in-chief of that journal, complaining to him because they had chosen young Jack Turbin's 2020 article as their like top article of 2020. And I'm like, how could you possibly select as your top article for the year this thing that is based on data mining, a giant online convenience sample survey that offered prizes for participation? You know, the 2015 USTS was designed to be a political survey and to let their politicians know that trans people need more support. It was not a medical, It was not a medical survey. Interestingly enough, none of those people consented to having their data put into a medical journal, the thing for which Dr. Michael Bailey's paper was recently retracted. Mm-hmm. But anyway, Jack's paper was selected as their number one paper of the year, and I wrote to him complaining. And first he told me, oh, that was just because it got the most clicks. You know, we did it based on engagement. And I'm like, well, I see you on this video saying that it's groundbreaking and all this. You're talking it up. And he's like, well, maybe you should submit a paper with your perspective. And this journal has something called Pediatric Perspectives, and it's supposed to be a short piece from a working pediatrician on, you know, the way they see things. So I submitted a paper, and I had that line in it that if you tell a small child that when they're older, the doctors will change their sex, they'll believe it. And it's cruel to imply that we can. And the response, they sent this out to gender doctors for review. And one of the doctors said that this statement would be offensive to pediatric readers of the journal Pediatrics.
Yeah, there's some really precocious young people.
I'm sure when you were in middle school, you were reading you were reading medical journals for fun.
Yeah, I was reading the virology, though. I I would have been safe from learning about the whether my sex could change or not.
Because you were a pretty bright kid. So, yeah. I was like, yeah, I was a pretty bright kid, but I wasn't reading any medical journals when I was in grade school. And then another one said, well, you know, we really can do a lot towards changing their sex. Mm-hmm. And I didn't get a chance to rebut these people. This was just like, we're rejecting your paper and here's why.
So, because you offended the gender doctors.
I offended the gender doctors, exactly, by pointing out that kids really can't make these decisions. And I feel like the parents are not in a good place to make the decisions either.
Which do you think
so
is more influencing the medical profession's desire to trans children? Is it the sense of being a groundbreaking hero, like a savior thing? Or is it money?
I think in terms of the pediatricians, it's the former. The impression I got from these doctors is that they are life-saving heroes. These poor, poor kids were just all going to kill themselves until they walked into their clinic and got assistance in becoming who they truly were. And yeah, they really feel like the suicide rate of unaffirmed kids is, you know, 75-80% or something like that.
Wow.
And of course there's no there's no statistics that support that notion.
I wanted to just dig into to suicide a little yes. bit here, because there's a difference between suicidal ideation or suicidality and attempts to commit suicide and completions yes. of suicide. Those are three different things, aren't they?
They're very different things. And obviously they're correlated. Mm-hmm. But if you show a decrease in suicidality, that is not proof that you have decreased the risk of completed suicide. Particularly in this situation, in this cultural milieu, in this population, where suicide is now part of the culture. I mean, it's bizarre. I was at that AAP meeting last fall, and I went to a presentation on suicide and suicide prevention. And I walked up to talk to the suicide expert who was, you know, teaching us. And I said, you know, over in the gender clinics, they're telling the parents that, you know, would you rather have a live daughter or a dead son? And this suicide expert just looked at me just stunned, like, they're what? Because it's just so far removed from what I was taught about how you deal with suicide and suicidality. And then the next day, I got a little video of one of the keynote speakers just lauding Lila Alcorn, saying that she boldly entered her life.
Yeah, and Lila Alcorn, that was a case of a suicide that happened in, what was that, I think 2014. Of a teenage boy in Cincinnati who, this would be right on the leading edge of this young transition cohort.
Yes.
Stepped in front of a
truck.
An 18-wheeler, yeah.
Yeah, stepped in front of a truck and had timed a suicide note to appear on social media. Mm-hmm. After the event. And I'm blanking on that doctor's name. She subsequently went to run the gender clinic in Tennessee. But she said, boldly stepped in front of a truck. And I was just sitting there, you know, like with my jaw open. I've got my phone perched on my knee. I'm sitting on the floor to video this. But I'm thinking, is nobody going to say anything? Like, this is just, it's just mind boggling. I feel like I live in the upside down. So many things have changed. We've forgotten, as pediatricians, we've forgotten what we were taught about child development. We've forgotten what we're taught about suicide prevention. It's just everything is backwards. You know, you've got the ACLU talking about burning books. You've got the gay rights organizations being actively homophobic. Everything is just turned around upside down and backwards. It's very disorienting.
So suicidality does seem to be part of the culture, as does increasingly homicidality.
Oh, dear. Yes. I don't know much about that. But something I wanted to mention was there was recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, the friggin' New England Journal of Medicine published Chen et al., 2023. And this was the big awaited long-term study of pediatric medicalization. I think 5 different clinics. This is supposed to be NIH-funded study, top of the line, the best gender care in the United States. And they had the most common side effect of this treatment was suicidality. And they had 2 completed suicides out of 315 patients they were following. And that is a horrific rate of completed suicide. That is 50 times the background rate for kids that age. It's probably 20 times sort of the rate for your average depressed or anxious kid. Because, I mean, definitely completed suicides are more common in depressed or anxious kids. But this 2 out of 315 is a crazy high rate. And they published it. And it's just, I mean, it's in the abstract, but they don't really draw your attention to that.
I know
fact.
A doctor here who mm-hmm. told me that she transes people locally, transes kids locally. Mm-hmm. And she said,
awesome.
Yeah, you know, because they'll commit suicide because of the suicide. And I just was like, I can't even. It's like she's reading journals. She's reading medical journals that are sharing this 41% made up statistic. She believes it. And so she's transing the local kids. And she like confessed right? it to me because she knows that I'm not, you know, that I don't approve of that. But I couldn't even start. I was like, where are they getting, like, this is what it is to be captured. They have limited yes. time. They trust these journals that they're reading. The journals are captured. They're mm-hmm. spoon fed lies. and so they're
yeah.
pumping kids full of hormones.
Pumping kids full of hormones. It's just, I had a conversation with a good friend of mine. We did our residency together and she's practicing in Los Angeles. And I'm saying, you know, it's this and this and this, and it's crazy. And she's like, you know, this whole thing, it's very confusing and I don't understand it. And I just want to refer to the specialists. And I was like, yeah, but if you refer to the specialists, they're only doing one thing. But she couldn't get past that, you know, because it's too scary to be like, no, really, I've read the papers and y'all are full of shit. This is not how it goes. You read it in the papers. They say, well, we know that this is helpful. So even when they're reporting bad results, they're like in the discussion, we're like, but we know this is helpful. So we just need to do more research to show. If we keep doing the research, we'll get the numbers.
As I read in one of the EPATH abstracts, there was a line that said that the data has not yet caught up to the practice.
Or I like the line that Jamie Reed reported her gender doctors said in a meeting, that they are building the plane as they are flying it. Really makes you feel.
It sounds safe as long secure. As you fly the plane low. Yeah.
Hit a few towers. Take out a few skyscrapers.
Collateral damage.
Do you suppose that it's possible in this reality, in this world that we're in, to trigger any type of preference cascade such that your fellow AAP members might revolt against the elites within the AAP that are endorsing this type of practice?
Yeah, well, I do think that the leadership is scared of that because they keep coming up with new rules to hide my resolutions from the rank and file pediatricians. So at first, Sarah Palmer's resolution was put up on the web. They're like, because of the pandemic, they're like, we're going to do this virtually. So here's all the resolutions, and you can kind of give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and you can leave comments. And her resolution was in the top five in terms of engagement, because a lot of resolutions just didn't get any engagement. And I'm not saying this is thousands of pediatricians. This is really more like dozens of pediatricians. But that was 3-1 or 4-1 positive for her, you know, in terms of thumbs up, thumbs down. And the comments were the same way. There were some comments that were like, this is horrible and transphobic and shouldn't be here. But the majority of comments were like, yes, I'm also concerned about this. So they learned from that. And the next year, when we had a resolution with five co-authors, it really does seem like they talked to our member of leadership that was going to sponsor our resolution, because we had somebody who is from a purple state, and so thought that they could see their way through to giving it a sponsorship. And then this person attended a leadership meeting, and then they kind of came back to us saying, yeah, you know, these statements come up for review every 5 years, and next year is 23. So it's going to happen anyway. So we really don't need a resolution telling the AP that they need to look at the data, because they're going to be doing it. And we're like, oh, you've had a pressure applied to you. So they had a new rule last year that unsponsored resolutions will not be available for the rank and file pediatricians to make comments or to give it a thumbs up or a thumbs down. So you could still read it. Like they had it in two different places on the website. So in one place, you could access the full text of all the resolutions. And in another place, there was a drop down list. And then you would select the resolution you wanted to comment on. And ours just wasn't there. It just went from 26 to 28. And then this year, they made a new rule saying that the AAP leadership reserved the right to determine that a resolution was unnecessary. And if they determine that the resolution is unnecessary, then they're just going to just kill it in the crib. And they did not do that with my resolution. My resolution, I've released it like via screenshots on Twitter. I'm still unsure as to like the rules and all this, whether I can just hand out PDFs, but I did share it via screenshots on Twitter, and all of our whereas were aimed at the fact that no, the AAP really isn't addressing, you know, our concerns. But so they didn't invoke that new rule. They're just going to rely on the one where nobody can comment. Oh, no, they have a new thing on the website. It says, if you comment, all comments must be on that resolution. Because what happened last year is people left comments on the resolution before or after ours. Like, what happened to resolution number 27? I wanted to say that it was good. And they have a new thing on the website saying, if you try to comment on a resolution that's not here, we're going to remove your comments. So I do think that the AAP is doing some sort of communication control, trying to keep the pediatricians who have concerns from realizing that they're not alone. They want everybody who feels like this is wrong to feel out, to feel alone, unsupported. Maybe I've got this wrong.
Okay,
maybe I
missed
something.
Is that motivated by the desire to be a savior? Like, what's motivating that? The individuals are
That's motivated by cover your butt. I think that what happened was 6 years ago, at least 6 years ago, young Jason Rafferty, still a resident, a protege of Michelle Forcier, the chicken lady.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So I don't know if you've seen Matt Walsh's documentary, What is a Woman? But he has a very nice conversation with a woman at Brown. And she's got blue hair and flowy clothing. And when he says, you know, we know it's a hen because it lays eggs, she responds, can a chicken commit suicide? Can a chicken cry? So the chicken lady was the teacher for Jason Rafferty. And so he went to the AAP leadership. And I'm guessing that he was, you know, young. He's very enthusiastic. And he's like, hey, there's this new thing. Trans is like, it's the new civil rights movement. Trans is the new gay. You got to be on the right side of history. We need to do this. We need to stand up. The AAP needs to stand up for trans kids. And the leadership, who are all sort of in their late 50s, early 60s, you know, and they're all liberals, right? The conservatives left over a decade ago. They're pediatricians. And they're like, oh, right. Definitely. I want to be on the right side of history. So yeah. Okay. Well, how about you write that up and we'll take a look at it. And so he wrote this thing up, but nobody actually took a look at it. Like nobody fact checked it, because James Cantor fact checked it after it was published. And it's full of holes. It's full of like a statement and then a reference. And you would assume that the reference is backing up the statement. But if you go and you check out the reference, it totally does not back up the statement that was made, that kind of stuff. And there is that weird little statement about the material here is the sole responsibility of Jason Rafferty. So there was somebody whose spidey sense was tingling that maybe this stuff wasn't completely on the up and up. But they did not go through it. They did not push back. They published it. And at this point, it's like the old saying, it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. At this point, they are just, they screwed up and they just keep digging a deeper hole. That's how I see it. I mean, I do not think these people are evil. I don't think that they are, you know, engaged in higher level United Nations plan 2030 population control. You know, if we trans all these kids, they'll be sterile and that will lower the population. I don't think anybody's thinking like that. I think that they were approached. They were told that if they wanted to be on the right side of history, they needed to take care of trans kids. They're like, oh, totally cool. And it is super complicated. And now they're just kind of stuck. And the leadership of the AAP is interesting in that the AAP has a president, but they also have the immediate past president and the president-elect at all times. There are three presidents like this. And then there's a few other people that are on the board of directors. And when we elect the president, we have two choices, which have been selected for us by the leadership. There's no primary process, you know? So the leadership gives us the appearance of democracy by presenting us with two candidates every year, but you got to pick one of them. And then they spend 2 years in the board meetings as the president-elect, and they get educated as to how it's going. And then they spend 2 years as the president, and then they spend 2 years as the immediate past president. So I think that the AAP leadership is at this point in for a penny, in for a pound, and they're just hoping that they can hang on. Because, I mean, I'm worried that the right lawsuit could, they have a lot of money, but I'm worried that the right lawsuit could do some serious damage. I found out that the money the AAP has is not from my membership fees, even though I am paying hundreds of dollars to be a fellow of the AAP. If I got, you know, 40% of the fellows to stop paying, and I do think this is a thing that's been happening. Like I collected the 23 co-sponsors and I had a lot of pediatricians saying they wanted to be a co-sponsor. And I said, well, are you an active fellow of the American Academy of Pediatrics? And they're like, oh no, I stopped sending them my money because, you know, I was unhappy about what they're doing. So I do think the numbers of members are going down, but that is not where their money comes from. Their money comes from endorsements with large corporations. And so even if I could get half of the AAP members to quit, it would not affect the decisions of the leadership. They're getting money from formula companies. They're getting money from toy companies. They're getting money from pharmaceutical companies.
That fact.
Stuff like that.
But that fact that they get their money from endorsements, that makes them a morally bankrupt organization or that just bankrupts their authority. Why does anybody give them any authority at all?
any credence at all. Well, you know, they've been the organization representing pediatricians for many decades, and they generally have done good work. But yeah, you know, there's a lot of, yeah, I don't know what to say. I'm politically homeless. I think you guys can identify with that feeling.
You're a disenchanted pediatrician.
I am a disenchanted pediatrician. I'm not ready to join the American College of Pediatricians, but I'm also unable to start my own. Well, I did. I started the Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine. So if you have any doctors that are in your listenership, send us a message. We have a contact us on our website. And to be perfectly honest, we're not like bringing in every single person that's interested, because we've got plenty of people now. But if you are interested in doing some of this work for free, if you're interested in, you know, writing letters to the editor, picking apart the statistics, things like that, helping other people write their papers, then yeah, definitely give us a call. Otherwise, just send us a donation. We need donations, because we're paying for open access fees for all of these papers so that everybody can read what we write. And those are remarkably expensive.
Is SEGM going to have any events?
SEGM is going to have events, but they're still off in the future. I don't think I can talk about them because they're not set up yet. But we do think it's time. It's time for a SEGM event. I went to the GenSpec conference in Killarney, and that was awesome. The interesting thing is that GenSpec was originally created by Zhenya because we needed an organization that could be more politically active. And that wasn't that long ago. That was like in 2021. But it is doing, you know, GenSpec is doing their own thing now, which is great. They're getting a lot done.
Did you, in Killarney, did you also go to the EPATH conference?
I didn't. I had to work and see patients and then fly on a red eye. And I actually missed I missed Helen Joyce's keynote speech. So I missed the beginning. So I didn't have any time to go to the EPATH.
Have you been to any WPATH events?
I've only been to sort of like virtually. I've seen things virtually, but I haven't been to any events in person. Aaron Terrell, right? I get the Aaron's confused. Uh-huh. Aaron, yep. Kimberly, Aaron Terrell asked me if I wanted to go to the transgender conference that was in San Francisco at the beginning of May, but that's when I was in Ireland, so I could not.
Are you going to go to the one in Denver?
Yes, I am going to go to the one in Denver. I am not a speaker. I think if I was a speaker, I would have been invited by now. But my co-author, Stephen Levine, he's going to be a speaker at the GenSpec conference in November in Denver.
But GenSpec's going to be in Denver because WPATH is also going to be in Denver.
Exactly. They are planning to be a thorn in their side. Or offer a different perspective is a better way to put that.
Well, maybe there will be an opportunity for us to get together again sometime this year.
Or for the first time in my case.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll bring Nina.
I might be sick again. I mean, my immunity's probably going to be just worn out by then.
Oh, no. Stay healthy, Nina. Keep riding 100-mile rides.
Yeah, I would like to. I couldn't really do anything about this.
Julia, thank you very, very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, turfs and trannies.
Bye.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for listening to Heterodorks. You can support us by visiting our page at anchor.fm/heterodorks or by supporting Nina Paley at patreon.com/Nina Paley. You can also support us by writing a review on your favorite podcast site, such as Apple Podcasts. Thank you.